And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is Chris Bojalian. Chris is the author of 8 novels. He won the New England Book Award in 2002. His novel Midwives was a number one New York Times bestseller, a selection of Oprah's Book Club, a Publisher's Weekly Best Book, and a New England Booksellers Association Discovery Pick. His work has been translated into 17 languages, been published in 20 countries, and twice become acclaimed movies, Midwives and Past the Bleachers. Transistor Radio is currently in development with Miramax and Wes Craven Films, and The Buffalo Soldier is in development with Columbia TriStar and Lifetime Television. He's written for a wide variety of magazines, including Cosmopolitan, Reader's Digest, and the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine. And this past Sunday, he was in Parade with an excerpt from his book that we're going to be talking about today, Idle Banter. He's been a Sunday columnist for Gannett's Burlington Free Press since 1992. And he lives in Vermont with his wife and daughter. And as I said, his most recent book is Idle Banter, Weekly Excursions to a Very Small Town. Hi, Chris.
Barbara, how are you?
Great to have you back.
You sure make me sound impressive.
You are impressive.
Thank you.
Idle Banter, it's such a wonderful book of essays. And I remember when we were in Vermont last April coming across one of your columns in the Burlington paper, and I was so happy to see them collected into this book. Will you talk about putting this book together and how that came about?
Sure, absolutely. The book's origins actually were at a reading when a woman said to me, "Do you keep a writing journal?" She was a young writer, an aspiring writer, and I said no, because I don't keep a writing journal, at least in the conventional sense, where as if I were Scott Fitzgerald, I would have snippets of dialogue, I would say, or if I were Annie Lamont and I had scenes from a grocery store that I thought someday I might want to use. I have nothing like that. And so I explained this to this young writer that, no, I really don't have a writing journal and I don't keep a diary. And then another person in the audience raised her hand and said, "Well, no, your Sunday column, that's your writing journal." And I realized she was absolutely correct. For 13 years, every single Sunday, I've written that column. And I've either chronicled my personal life, or I've chronicled issues that would be reflected later on in my books, whether it was an interest in midwifery, or an interest in the transgendered, or an interest in foster care. And so when I related the story to my editor at Random House, we thought it would be interesting to see if it would be possible to collect those columns in a way that would either chronologically show how rural America has changed in the last decade, or perhaps how one particular writer's life has evolved in the last decade. And I hope this book does both. I think the stuff about America is infinitely more interesting than anything about my life, because most of the things I write about in regard to my personal life are how incredibly inept I am when it comes to running a home. When I'm writing about my daughter and my wife, I think those can be pretty interesting. Or my neighbors.
Interesting. So were there pieces that you left out? Did you have to sort of pick amongst them all and say this one is more universal than that one and it will apply to a national or international readership?
Yes. The short answer is yes. I wanted this book to be as relevant in Los Angeles as it is in Lincoln, Vermont, where I live. I wanted this book to be as interesting to a reader in San Francisco as it would be to a reader in Miami, Florida, or Nashua, New Hampshire. So I did try to pick those columns that are the most universally interesting, that reflect our most common experiences, ranging from parenting to 9/11, to the first time you visit Disneyland with a 5-year-old and have to explain why Minnie is in 17 different places at once.
Oh, that's great. Do you have a favorite or any that you especially like in this book, or are they all, do they all just fill different oh, I don't know, different parts of you that there's no way one could be a favorite?
You know, no, novelists are despicable parents, first of all, when it comes to our books, because we always love our most recently published the best. As a columnist, you always have favorites as well. And I hope these do reflect, I hope these essays and columns are among my very, very favorites. And I did have a lot to choose from. Counting my magazine essays, I had at least 700 columns or articles from which to choose. And I think this book only has 60 or 65 essays in it. So you might say it is, if not my favorite 10%, pretty close to my favorite 10%, and certainly my favorite ones that are as interesting in Lincoln, Vermont, as they are in Midtown Manhattan.
Interesting. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here today with Chris Bojalian, author of Idle Banter, Weekly Excursions to a Very Small Town, published by Harmony Books. Talk about the form, the essay form, because you have these other novels, these wonderful novels, which I've read three more since you were on last.
And God bless you.
And, you know, you're just so versatile, and your voice is so singular as a novelist. And so I'm curious what it is about the essay form, what you like about it, and what the difference is for you in writing an essay as opposed to writing a novel.
The first difference is the gratification and the satisfaction that you get. When I have a column in a newspaper or when I have an article in Parade magazine, I get feedback instantly. This past Sunday, you mentioned that story I had in Parade magazine.
Yes.
Well, it's about a wonderful, wonderful young man with Down syndrome named Ian Freeman. Ian and I became pals through community theater because my daughter and his mother happened to be in a show together. And so we would carpool, and we became great buddies. So I wrote an essay about how much I have learned from this 15-year-old with Down syndrome about living spectacularly in the moment and how he's capable of hugging anyone unconditionally. I mean, you know, he and I hug more than my brother and I hug, and good God, we've known each other for 40 years. So I wrote this essay about this experience, and it was in Parade magazine on Sunday, and by Sunday at 6 p.m., I must have had, I don't know, 25 or 30 emails to my website from people I will probably never meet from around the country with their thoughts about the article or relating anecdotes about their own experience or their own children who have developmental disabilities. And it was great. I wrote that article this summer. It was published this December, and I had feedback right away. When I write a newspaper column, I might write it on a Thursday, and 72 hours later, I'm getting feedback on it. That's very different from a novel. My next novel goes on sale in October of 2004. I've finished my second draft of it. I started this book in September 2001. So it will altogether be 3 years from the time I had an idea for a novel and the time I start getting feedback on it.
Hmm.
And novels are always like that. Even when I write a novel pretty quickly, it's still start to publication going to be at least 2 years.
So the essay is really immediate gratification.
It is. It is. And it's also an opportunity to plumb something at a different level, not necessarily shallower, but different from a novel. If I were to write a novel about, for example, if I were to write a novel about Ian, this terrific kid with Down syndrome, it would be a very different experience than writing an essay about him. When I write an essay about him, I focus on these small idiosyncratic moments, singing with him in the car, you know, belting out show tunes from the secret garden in the car and doing the Mandy Patinkin roles, versus a novel where you'd find yourself, you know, doing a lot. I would have done tons more research into Down syndrome. I would have had to understand a lot more about raising a child with Down syndrome than I need to know for that essay. Because in an essay, you're really trying to convey one thing, or one point, or one moment, and render it exquisitely. And that's a different sensation. When I write about my daughter in 675 words, I'm picking out one anecdote that strikes me as one of those iconic parental moments we've all had. And that's what I focus on.
Hmm.
I love columns. I mean, I wouldn't have done this for 13 years if I didn't love it. I wouldn't write magazine essays if I didn't love that shorter form.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting to learn through reading Idle Banter that in your weekly column you don't promote your books. You don't promote yourself as a novelist.
Nope.
That's interesting.
And I do that very consciously, because I never want my newspaper column to be viewed as a commercial for my work as a novelist.
Sure.
And I think only three times in 13 years I've alluded to being a novelist. One time was the Sunday before I was going to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show for Oprah's Book Club, and because she had filmed it in Vermont, it would have been this incredible elephant in the room that we weren't talking about if I didn't address it in my newspaper column, because there were a lot of news stories about Oprah Winfrey being in Vermont. And the other times were once when I was writing about very silly stories on book tours, and then once when I was writing about a little boy who I was sitting next to on a long flight from, I think it was Portland, Oregon, to Chicago, and then he was continuing on to Florida and I was continuing on to Vermont, and my conversation with this little boy on the airplane.
Interesting. Will you read to us from Idle Banter?
I would be happy to.
If you just tuned in again, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and Chris Bojalian's about to read from Idle Banter, Weekly Excursions to a Very Small Town, published by Harmony Books this month.
Okay, this is an essay, and it'll take about 3.5 minutes to read. And it's called A Family's Farewell to Tiger. In the woods beside the Gale family's sugar house is a small paddock, empty now for almost a month. On a particularly glorious Saturday in October, the leaves on the sugar maples glowing neon yellow in the sun, a dusting of white at the top of Mount Abraham, the sky above both a crisp, deep blue. The horse who'd called that paddock home died between a lone rock and a tree in a nearby meadow. The earth here in Lincoln is probably filled with the bodies of old Appaloosas and Morgans, and I imagine there was somebody present at the very end to grieve for them all. In the case of Tiger, Gumbo, Tiger Lily C, to be precise, there was Jennifer Gale, the horse's 13-year-old owner, caretaker, and friend, as well as Jennifer's parents. I think the fact Tiger had mourners is important, but it isn't unique. What might be rare is the affecting ritual that Jennifer offered her horse and her family at the end, the moving and meticulous ways she marked Tiger's passing. If a horse has to die, and according to the veterinarian, it was indeed time for the sickly 28-year-old to be given her rest, it is good to go the way Tiger did. There was the public farewell party Friday afternoon, one of those occasions the soul craves because the emotions are deep and complex. It's possible to juggle sorrow and joy when the horse that will die tomorrow is surrounded today by the children she's known the last years of her life. There is young Lynn Sipsey, a 7-year-old whom Jennifer taught to ride atop Tiger. There is 9-year-old Prudence Minier, who's been friends with Tiger since they were photographed together one day. And there, in a crowd of boys and girls between the ages of 6 and 13, is Nugget Meg, a horse friend of Tiger's who's come by for one final visit. Yet this isn't a dirge-filled pre-death vigil. The children are dangling from trees. They're jumping from the loft of the Gale's barn. They're racing Tiger and Nugget Meg. They're eating absolutely massive amounts of apple cobbler. Are they sad? No doubt. They understand what will happen tomorrow, but they are also raucous and loud and giggling sometimes, such as when Tiger tickles the palms of their hands as she munches the carrots they offer. Jennifer's carefully choreographed celebration of Tiger's last afternoon might have made the almost preternatural quiet that filled the next morning somewhat easier for her to bear. The next day, she walked her horse the 3/4 of a mile to the meadow she'd chosen for Tiger's last home and waited there alone for her parents, Don and Jody, and the veterinarian to arrive. Tiger, a leopard Appaloosa, wore a pine bough wreath around her neck. As the pair waited, 3 horses walked by along the road beside the pasture. 2 were chestnut, and 1 was white with black speckles. Tiger was pretty near blind at the end, so she didn't see them. But she heard them, or smelled them, or sensed them. She knew they were there. And so she whinnied a greeting of sorts in their direction. And the riders slowed their animals and waved. For a moment, they watched the girl and her horse in the field. And then, perhaps sensing their presence was an intrusion, they quickly rode on. When the veterinarian reached the meadow, he stood for a long time with a syringe the size of a thermos in his hand. If Jennifer might have preferred his hiding the needle until it was time, she kept the notion to herself. She might have suspected this was no easy task for the vet either. Tiger went fast, her body collapsing atop her legs like the canvas seat on a director's chair once the braces have been unclasped. Jennifer stayed with her a moment, her cries considerably softer than her mother's. But as Jody murmured, her words rich with pain and love, "It's easy for her to be strong. She doesn't have to see her daughter's heart breaking."
Thank you so much. That was Chris Bojalian reading from Idle Banter. What a moving piece. Oh, my goodness.
I was so impressed with Jennifer in that story. Jennifer is one of Jennifer, Jody, and Don, her mother and father, are neighbors of mine in Lincoln. And I was mesmerized when I looked back on all of the stories I had heard or had witnessed from my neighbors. A friend of mine who writes exclusively nonfiction, and I once were on a panel together, and somebody said to me, "Who is the more difficult job, you, Chris, as a novelist, or this other gentleman who writes history?" And I said, "You know, I think I've got the easier job as a novelist, because I can make it up. I don't have to be truthful. I don't have to be scrupulously accurate with everything that I do." And you know, this gentleman with me kind of nodded. But one of the things I learned from this book is that in some ways it was easier than writing fiction, because I had the great resource of all my neighbors and all of their true stories, so that they did the heavy sledding. They did the heavy lifting, you know, with their openness and their candor. The whole notion that Jennifer allowed me to be with her that afternoon when she was having her horse euthanized. That was a very, very special moment, and while a part of me felt like a voyeur being there, as if it was inappropriate for me to be there because I wasn't her father, a part of me felt very privileged and very blessed that she was okay with this story being chronicled, and that she was okay with me being the chronicler.
Yeah. Well, I've wondered, because your writing, your nonfiction and your fiction takes place in Vermont, how do you think your writing would be affected if you didn't live in Vermont? Say you had stayed in New York, or you moved to California, or you moved to Europe. I guess what I'm saying is, how much influence does place have on your writing, do you think?
Yeah. Place, you know, I think it would depend on where I moved in terms of how much place would have on my writing. It's a great question. I think some places lend themselves to stories better than others, and I think some writers are better for some places. You know, there are obviously great great novels set in Los Angeles, and there are great stories set in Iowa, and there are great novels set in Manhattan. Vermont happens to have been a great place for me to have done at least my apprentice fiction and my first novels. My first eight. Hopefully I'll write another 16 or 24.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure why that is, except for it might have been as simple as size. Apprentice writers often begin with short stories before trying to tackle the long form. And Vermont is a very small place. You can really wrap your arms around it, I think, easier than you can pick a place than Miami, Florida.
Sure.
And part of it is the reality that only 640,000 people live in our state. When I wanted to write a book about the foster care program,
mm-hmm.
I could pick up the phone, call the head of human services for the entire state, go out to lunch with him a week later. He was great, introduced me to all kinds of social workers who in turn introduced me to exactly the sorts of foster care situations and foster families that I needed to talk to. Imagine if I needed to talk to the head of human services for the state of New York or the state of Florida.
Hmm.
Here's how small we are. We are reading, obviously, a lot about Howard Dean. Howard Dean was an extraordinary governor and just a wonderful, wonderful man. And here's how small our state is. When my little village, Lincoln, lost our entire library in a flash flood late on a Friday night, early on a Saturday morning, 5 feet of water poured into the brick monolith that housed the library, and so 80% of the collection had to be pulped. Monday, 2 days later, Howard Dean and his wife, in a station wagon, brought over just tons and tons of books that were either their children's books or that had belonged to neighbors, because you look out for each other in this state, and they'd read in the newspaper on Sunday about the plight of this little village and this library.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, but Vermont has something else happening with it, too, because I think of a state like, okay, Rhode Island, which is really small, and,
yeah.
There's not at least I don't hear of a lot of interesting writing coming out of that place.
No, you're absolutely right. There is something special about Vermont. I wasn't at all surprised in the year 2000 that we were the first state to legitimize civil union. If any state was going, if you'd said to me in 1975, pick a state that in a quarter century is going to have civil union for gay couples, I would, I think I might have said Vermont very quickly. We are a wonderful multiple personality state, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that. We are very close to Boston and New York City and Montreal. On the other hand, we have a great agrarian heritage and a hardscrabble culture. So you do have this multiple personality occurring, and that's great fodder for fiction. Supposedly you need two things in successful fiction. You need conflict, and you need human transformation. And right now, Vermont is this glorious microcosm for cultural changes occurring everywhere as the fringes of our culture push against the mainstream. Traditional versus alternative medicine, home versus hospital birth, all of the wonderful new definitions of family we are seeing now that are so different from Leave It to Beaver and Dennis the Menace and Father Knows Best, and of course all that baggage that we bring to gender and sexual orientation. You can see all of that conflict here in Vermont in a way that you don't, as you rightly pointed out, in a place like Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's another reason. And I hadn't thought of this until you just asked this question. I think that's another reason that maybe in Vermont I found my voice as a writer much more quickly than I believe I would have had I continued to live in New York City and remained a running slime dog of capitalism in an ad agency.
When we come back, I want you to tell our listeners about deciding to leave New York.
Okay.
Anyway, let's take a real quick break. We'll be right back with more Chris Bojalian. Don't go away.
One more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we have been here since 5 with Chris Bojalian, author of Idle Banter, Weekly Excursions to a Very Small Town, published by Harmony Books just this month, just recently. Wonderful book of essays. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Before the break, you talked about how you felt that living in Vermont helped you find your voice. Will you talk a little bit more about that, about voice? And yours certainly is distinct in your novels and in this book of essays.
Well, thank you very much. One of the things that I think these columns and my novels share is they all focus on ordinary people, sometimes in extraordinary circumstances. For example, a mother dies in a home birth and the midwife who's caring for her is suddenly beleaguered and on trial. A popular public school teacher, much to her astonishment and chagrin, suddenly falls in love with a man who's in the midst of his sexual reassignment to become a woman. In my columns, I'm writing very often about those very, very same sorts of people. Maybe the situations aren't as heartbreaking, or they aren't as extraordinary, but, you know, I love writing about, for example, one of my neighbors who's a midwife. I've discovered I love writing about school teachers. I love writing about children. The book that I just finished, the novel that comes out next summer, is almost entirely from the perspective of a 13-year-old girl and her 11-year-old cousin. My favorite parts of Transistor Radio, I think, are those scenes from the perspective of Carly Banks, a 19-year-old.
Yes.
And in The Buffalo Soldier, I loved re-inhabiting, in my case, you know, a 10-year-old boy's perspective. And in my columns, I think my favorite section in Idle Banter, my new book of essays, are all of the columns and essays about children. And, you know, there's a whole section about that called The School, Playgrounds and Classrooms. And it's just some of my favorite essays about kids and growing up. And then scattered, of course, throughout the book are essays about my daughter at everything from practically when she was born till she was 9, and she just turned 10. I love writing about children, and that, too, is an important part of my voice.
Your novels, as you've said, deal with Vermont, from dowsing to homeopathy to midwifery to gender issues, transgender issues. How do you locate voice? Because the situations are all dramatic, but they're all very different people, different characters.
I never start writing a book until I know the voice, almost as if I were a ventriloquist. And I can't start writing a book, no matter how much I know about the plot in my head or the subject matter, until I have a really firm grasp of the narrator. And usually that comes to me in one of those sort of glorious moments of surprise. I'll give you two examples. I spent at least 6 months researching midwifery after I decided to write a novel about a midwife before I wrote a single word. And that's because I didn't have a sense of who the narrator was. And if I'd started the book immediately after I grew interested in the subject, I had this terrible fear I would have made this ridiculous error and had the book narrated by a male defense attorney, perhaps, or a male prosecutor, or perhaps a midwife's husband. When I think the reason that book works so well is because it's narrated by a woman,
right?
And it's a book about birth. Well, about 6 months into my research, I had this wonderful moment. It was the end of the day. My then infant daughter, about a year old, was in my arms, and I was giving her a bottle. And it was one of those moments where you've got 15 pounds in your arms that you love more madly than you ever thought you could love anything. And I was thinking back on my day, and I remembered a story that the 4-year-old goddaughter of some friends of my wife and mine, had told us about this 4-year-old goddaughter who had come home from preschool entranced by the word vulva. She knew this was a perfectly fine word, but she also knew that every time she said it, her mom and dad were going to sweat buckets. And so a sentence came into my head as I was giving my daughter a bottle. I used the word vulva as a child, the way some kids said butt or penis or puke. It wasn't a swear exactly, but I knew it had an edge to it that could stop adults cold in their tracks. Well, as soon as Grace was asleep, I placed her in her crib, and I wrote that sentence down. And then I called the 19-year-old daughter of a midwife I'd interviewed, and I said to her, Erin, I have no idea how to ask you this question politely, so just kind of hang with me. But when you were a little girl, did you have a greater comfort level with the anatomic terrain than your peers? And without missing a beat, she laughed and said, yeah, I was always the most popular kid in the sandbox. and so instantly I knew that this was a midwife's daughter speaking, and this book should be narrated from the perspective of a midwife's daughter. And yet there are a lot of reasons for that I discovered as I was working on the book in terms of a sense of irony about the language of birth that would have been absent had this book been narrated by a very, very sincere midwife, and an opportunity to have a sense of foreshadowing without culpability. And so that was one choice on voice, and another would be transistor radio. I knew how pivotal the voice of the transsexual, this male to female transsexual, was going to be, and I couldn't figure out how to get this voice where I wanted it, and who the transsexual was. What was she really like? What did she do for a living? Excuse me. And I was going through all of these books that I bought for the transgender, including this one book that is quite literally about how to speak like a female after you've had sexual reassignment surgery. And all of a sudden, a sentence came into my head, and then a few others right after. How do you speak like a woman? I've read all the books, and I don't know how many articles, a lot. I've read all about adverbs and qualifiers. Women supposedly use lots more of both than men, and how females are more likely than males to phrase a statement in the form of a question. Shall we go to dinner? Aren't those shoes lovely? And I had this sense right away that, okay, she has a tremendous sense of irony about who she is and who she's becoming, and she might even be an English professor, which she would become. And then I was off and running on that book, and all of the research that I had done on the transgendered came into play, beginning with that moment when I figured out voice.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, okay, so just because you brought up midwives, I wanted to ask you a question in terms of structure, and which I really like about this book, and that is because the beginning that you talked about you know, using the word vulva, you have a prologue here that kind of gives an overview of what happened, and then you go to the beginning, to chapter one. Did the prologue come before or after the book was written?
That's a wonderful question. No. I wrote the prologue when I was about 100 to 125 pages into Midwives. The book began quite literally with that sentence. I used the word vulva as a child. That, you know, that became the first sentence of the first chapter I wrote. And when I was about 100 to 120 pages into the book, and I had a sense of just how dark this book was becoming, I wanted to immediately immerse the reader into the courtroom drama. There are a lot of things happening in Midwives. It's a mother-daughter love story, I think, first and foremost. It's an exploration of the place of birth in our culture. It's a mystery, and it's a courtroom drama. And I wanted to make it clear to readers from page one that this isn't... I mean, Connie's got a great sense of humor. the narrator. And I think her mother, Sybil, the midwife, had a great sense of humor. But it's going to be a dark book, and it's a courtroom drama, and so I wanted to right away flag that for the reader, and that's how, you know, why the novel actually begins. Throughout the long summer before my mother's trial began, and then during those crisp days in the fall when her life was paraded publicly before the county, her character lynched, her wisdom impugned, I overheard much more than my parents realized, and I understood more than they would have liked. So that is when I wrote the prologue, when I was about 100 to 150 pages into the book. You know, the book also didn't have all of those diary entries mm-hmm. that are so pivotal to the ending until I was about 300 to 350 pages into the book.
Huh.
This is a first-person novel, but while Sybil Danforth, the midwife on trial, was watching the jury voir dire, watching the jury being chosen, I wanted to know what she was thinking. I wanted to share with the reader what Sybil was thinking, but I couldn't just parachute suddenly into Sybil's head. This book is told entirely by Connie as a memoir. It's Connie's autobiography, essentially, of this horrible, horrible summer. And so I had to figure out a way to convey what Sybil was experiencing, and I tried newspaper articles in which she's quoted. I tried very clinical medical journals. I tried testimony exclusively. And then I glommed onto, fortunately, the notion of diary entries, and that Sybil was an inveterate diary keeper.
Speaking of those entries, I think in four of your novels, you have some sort of entry or excerpt at the beginning of chapters, which I think is just such a wonderful, I don't want to say a gimmick because it's, that would imply that there's no depth there, you know. But, you know, it is one of those literary techniques or a style that I love when I see it, and I hardly ever see it. And has that sort of become a signature of you, do you think? Or
it might have, but I never set out to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In each of those novels, those sort of prologues before each chapter, those inserts before each chapter, they were helping to solve a very specific problem. In Midwives, it was so the reader could have a sense of what Sybil's thinking in an otherwise first-person novel. In Transistor Radio, there are all of those excerpts from All Things Considered story on the transgender. And the reason why they are there is because I wanted readers to have necessary background on both the history of transsexuality and what state-of-the-art surgery these days involves. It's information the reader had to have to understand Dana. But I couldn't just parachute it into the dialogue. I mean, you just couldn't have a mom sitting around the dinner table with her ex-husband or her current husband, you know, and saying something to the effect of, "Well, you know, don't you, honey, that transsexual surgery has been around in one form or another for almost 2,000 years. And I needed to convey that in a smooth way. And one day I was taking a walk, and a car drove past that was listening to All Things Considered, and I heard Linda Wertheimer's voice. And I suddenly had this great vision of Linda Wertheimer, who, like you, Barbara, is just going to those voices that is just beautiful and perfect on the radio, talking about the transgendered. And I thought, okay, there's how we can explain those details. And in The Buffalo Soldier, we have a series of fictional letters. Actually, some of those parts of The Buffalo Soldier, some of those letters are real, and some of that congressional testimony, mm-hmm. especially the stuff that's really offensive and racist and appalling and will make you angry beyond words, is, alas, real. Those were to convey so that the reader knows what this character in my novel, Alfred Benoit, this 10-year-old African-American foster child, is reading in this book that's been given to him by this wonderful older man who takes him under his wing.
Hmm.
So, it might be a signature of sorts, but it's usually there because I've painted myself into a corner and I need to solve a very specific problem in the book. You know, every house has plumbing and wiring, and you don't see it, but you have to have it. Sometimes I look at those things and I realize that They're the plumbing and the wiring that a really good novelist would find a way to hide in the walls.
Yes. Well, I don't know, though. I'm saying yes, I can see where novelists might do that, but these beginnings really illuminate almost what's to come. In The Law of Similars, the Hahnemann excerpts of homeopathy are just perfect.
Thank you. So those are of course real entries.
Sure.
from the founder of homeopathy's textbooks that he wrote on homeopathy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean I love the technique. And I'm also curious about your novels, and they're all very dramatic, at least the five that I've read. They're very dramatic and would seem to have been plotted out because there's so much depth and texture. Do you plot, do they begin that way, or as you go through them, does the texture kind of, do you lay it on and say, well, you know, this has to happen too, and, you know, just kind of apply another layer?
You know, John Irving contends that you should never write the first sentence of a novel until you can write the last. And if I subscribe to that, I would have written zero novels, because I never have any idea where my books are going when I start. I have a vague notion. I have a premise. Woman dies in a home birth. Woman falls in love with a man having a sex change to become a woman. But aside from that, I have no idea where the book is going. And the reality is that my characters are a litter of kittens. I try to herd them in some general direction of the storyline, but most of the time they will ignore me completely and do their own thing. Sometimes this results in books going through many, many, many drafts, and not simply because I'm tightening sentences, but because I'm reconfiguring something as I've just learned something about a character, or I've discovered something interesting that could or should occur. Midwives is another case in point. Without wanting to ruin the ending for people who haven't read Midwives and someday might, the ending hinges a lot on diary entries. And I was 300 pages into the first draft of the manuscript before there was a single diary entry in existence. So once I realized that the diary entries were going to matter, I went all the way back to page one and started again. Transistor Radio began as simply a love story to see how broad love's shoulders could be. You've got a character named Allison Banks, a female school teacher, and you've got a character named Dana Stevens, a male-to-female transsexual. And the entire book was going to explore, would they be together at the end? That would be the conflict for the reader. Will Dana and Allison be together at the end, or will they have separated? There's a third character who figured in the book named Will, Allison's ex-husband, and his original purpose was simply to be the voice of tranny-phobic unreason. Sort of this despicable, doctrinaire pedant. But as the book evolved, all of a sudden, he became attracted to Dana after her sexual reassignment surgery as well, as he saw this wonderful butterfly that was starting to emerge, and the book changed into this game of musical chairs in which there were three grown-ups and only two chairs, and who would be the odd grown-up out at the end. And so that meant going back again to page one and reconfiguring the book. Idle Banter, the essay collection, didn't have that problem.
Yeah.
Since I was dealing with, you know, whatever it was, 700 articles to choose. The principal problem that book actually provided was figuring out how I could offer the reader not necessarily a linear narrative, but a cohesive story about Lincoln. And, you know, in this case, it's Lincoln, Vermont, which I hope is sort of an interesting microcosm for changes occurring everywhere in the country. And in some ways, I hope a real-life Lake Wobegon. I mean, all these eccentrics that I live with, these, you know, wonderful, real people.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It is. And if you just tuned in, you're a little bit late. We've been here with Chris Bojalian, author of Idle Banter, Weekly Excursions to a Very Small Town, published by Harmony Books. ideas that stick, whether it's an essay or a novel, you know, because writers have so many ideas flowing through them at any given moment. How do you know one is sticking and one isn't? Is it something you dream about? Do you obsess? Is it something that you just won't leave you alone?
I do have one pretty good barometer. I start work every day at 5 in the morning. And if an idea isn't sufficiently jazzy to me that I'm capable of getting up at 5 in the morning, then I shouldn't finish the book. I will halt the book. I can think of at least 3 times in the last decade that I've been anywhere between 60 and 200 pages into a novel, anywhere from 3 months to, you know, 8 or 9 months, when I said, you know what? This idea isn't sticking, just to use that metaphor you just used. This idea isn't working. I don't care passionately enough about it. I've lost interest in it. Because if I, as a novelist, don't care enough about the book to get up at 5 a.m. to write about it, then it's certainly not going to be sufficiently interesting, or I'm not going to do the material sufficient justice for a reader to invest, you know, 4 to 25 hours of her life on the book.
So how conscious are you of the reader or your audience? Are you writing for anyone in particular? Or are you writing a story, an essay, a novel that you need to write to explore either questions or concerns you have? You know, is anyone there?
The short answer is yes. I am always conscious of my readers. And I say that not because I'm careful to market to a specific demographic, but because I'm always conscious of the fact that somebody's going to be shelling out $25 for this in hardcover or $13 in paperback, and just because either I have a deadline or my publisher has a deadline doesn't mean to just, you know, crank something out. I also don't want to ever be self-indulgent. I think all writers are capable of becoming very self-indulgent in either grandstanding or having a wonderful time showing off some literary pyrotechnics. I think it's important not to do that. There's a place for literary pyrotechnics, and there's certainly a place to be a magnificent stylist, but I think very often the best stylists are the invisible stylists who aren't simply writing a book because they want to be jazzy and show off, or because they've got some horrible demon from their childhood that they need to exorcise, and, you know, dear God in heaven, they're going to do it in 115,000 words and 400 pages and you know, sell it as a novel. The short answer is yes, I'm aware that I'm writing for people, I sort of have a sense of who reads my books. I've done enough public readings that I know who's in the audience, but I try never to write specifically. I try never to write specifically to satisfy a demographic.
Yeah, interesting. And we have a minute or two left, Chris. Do you have any last words for the writers listening who may need a touch of
have low standards. I was asked the other night at a reading for Idle Banter. Somebody said, "You're really prolific. You know, you've written 8 books. You write all these columns and book reviews and magazine essays. How do you do it?" And I said, "I have low standards." the most important thing I try to tell aspiring writers or young writers is to have fun when you are alone with your computer or your pen or however you write. But to, you know, savor the process and not to get caught up in that notion of completion, not to get it caught up in that notion of writer's celebrity, but to just savor the blessing and the privilege of the chance to spend a little time crafting a lovely sentence or a beautiful line of dialogue and just seeing where it goes.
Excellent advice. Once again, thank you so much for being here. And your next book comes out.
You
come back.
I will always come back.
Okay.
Thanks.
You're welcome. That was Chris Bojalian speaking to us from Lincoln, Vermont. His book is Idle Banter, Weekly Excursions to a Very Small Town, published by Harmony Books. His website is www.chrisbojalian.com, and that is chrisbojalian.com. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website at writersonwriting.com, and there you may email me and tell me you want to be on my weekly email list, and I'll be happy to put you on it. And you won't get any spam from me. No siree. I keep changing my email address so to get rid of spam. I'd like to leave you with a quote by Erica Jong, who said, "Fear is a sign, usually a sign, that I'm doing something right." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I hope you all have very happy holidays. I'll be back in the new year. I think January 8th is the next time I'll be here. In the meantime, please take care and enjoy.